Great to have you with us for another edition of Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Hi, Larry Mueller here. I'm going to start the show today by talking a little bit about working with plants. Those who have it as an vocation. We'll also talk about, of course, those of us who have gardening and plants as kind of an avocation. Jennifer Jewell is with us. She's the author of The Earth in Her Hands, 75 Extraordinary Women Working in the World of Plants. She also writes and hosts the national award-winning weekly public radio program and podcast, Cultivating Place. And with us as well today is Ben Fuda. Ben is director of the Allen Centennial Gardens in Madison. So as we listen to them, I'm wondering, is working with plants part of your vocation? Why do you enjoy it? What are the nice things and maybe not as nice things about it? Join in at 1-800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Jennifer Jewell, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here working from home.
Yeah. During these times, that's what most people are doing. Ben Fuda, are you with us?
I am, yes. Great to be here.
All right. Thank you both so much. Jennifer, tell us about your radio show first. What's it all about?
Cultivating Place, Conversations on Natural History and the Human Impulse to Garden, is a now four-year-old public radio one-hour interview-based program produced out of Northern California, North State Public Radio here in Chico, California. And it is an extension of a program I started in 2008. And it focuses on that intersection between the natural history of our places and our human impulse to garden, which I consider to be as broad as a person's enjoyment of walking on a trail or just enjoying the tree in their back garden, not necessarily needing to be as extensive as some of us, where we need to garden all day, every day, if we possibly can. And it interviews people from around the world doing interesting things in gardening and in horticulture. So writers and, you know, directors of programs. And I'm really sorry that you might be hearing background noise here in my neighborhood this morning, but and what's great about the radio is that as you know, Larry, is that you don't have to have a garden that is worthy of a, you know, big photo shoot in a glossy magazine. You just have to love to garden to be able to talk about it meaningfully.
And here on Garden Talk, we've been doing this show every Friday for, I don't even know how many years, 10 or 15. It's been probably 15 years or so at least.
Yeah.
And giving people a chance to call in. And it's the kind of show that I think we get a sense of community through this particular show, probably through yours as well,
exactly.
With gardeners coming together, calling in, asking questions. And then oftentimes, if my guest expert or I don't have an answer, somebody else listening will call in. And so it's that beautiful sense of community that you get around gardens. Yeah, Ben Fuda has been with us a number of times, so Ben knows all about this. But talk about the Allen Centennial Gardens, Ben. It's great to have you with us. Thanks for joining in, by the way.
Yeah, of course. For those who don't know, of course, the garden is on the UW-Madison campus here in Wisconsin. And again, it's an interesting time for all of us thinking about, especially working in a public garden space. You know, the public of the public garden is very interesting right now. Like so many others, many of our programs and events have been postponed or canceled and sort of reorganized. And we're really taking stock both voluntarily and sort of by, you know, the powers that be of just what's happening in the world right now to really evaluate what's critical versus maybe what is, quote unquote, simply productive in our garden. But of course, that is that's the irony, is that sometimes being simply productive in a garden is exactly what is critical. And so, you know, we've prioritized in this moment sort of those things that will, you know, we don't have volunteers right now. We don't have our student interns. And so we really prioritize those things that will set us up for at least immediate success in the spring. So things like early mulching to keep weeds down, things like mowing our borders and sort of keeping that brown material in place rather than hauling things to the compost. And, you know, not only is that just good sort of ecological practice that we would normally follow, but we're sort of doing that a little bit more than we normally would so that the precious few hours that our director of horticulture has on site can really be put to the best use. So it's an interesting time in all gardens right now.
Think about it for a minute. Jennifer, maybe... Well, you both do work that involves plants. From your perspective, how does that connect you to your communities?
Well, I would say that gardening, just by its very nature, being one of those human activities that people have engaged in across time and culture and space, for so many different reasons, for beauty, for medicine, for food, for utility. It is one of the great common grounds, like all of literature and art and music and food. It is one of these places that people transcend all of their other differences when they find that common ground of the garden. And in my community, certainly, I live in a rural agricultural region. The growing traditions are long and deep. They are of the indigenous peoples and of the settler communities. And there is just this great sort of universal connection in the soil, in the weather, in the production from the garden, whether that's flowers or almonds or cauliflower.
Yeah. Ben, what about you? Comment on that? How does you get to connect pretty intimately when there's not a pandemic with your communities as well? Maybe how are you doing it now?
I think, you know, we're sort of joining the ranks of many other museums, public gardens, and other cultural institutions where we are you know, putting some more effort than normal, perhaps, into social media and the digital sphere. Of course, this is tricky for us because so much of gardening is the immersive nature of it, the smells, all of the senses sort of being a part of the experience. And for us to say, you know, sharing images of here's what's blooming or here's what's happening certainly is engaging one of those senses. But it, you know, they haven't invented smell-o-vision emails yet. you know, I would love to send people, you know, things to touch if they don't have a garden of their own to get out into. But I also think that's, you know, we're seeing right now, you know, just in conversations and art, you know, people are really sort of zeroing in on what matters and taking stock of what is critical in their lives right now. Speaking both personally and professionally, you know, we're stepping back and sort of saying, what matters? Where am I going to invest my time? You know, does the schedule I've been maintaining, is that really what's important? And so I think not only that's what this moment is spurring us to do, but I think, a friend, a colleague that I follow and really like has a phrase that I've been sort of putting in my roster, and that's the crisis is a terrible thing to waste. And so I'm sort of approaching this personally as this is the moment of not only public gardens, but gardening in general that, you know, today this was intended as a conversation as a part of our annual symposium. And of course, that isn't happening, the symposium. But again, Jennifer is able to join us. We're still having some of these conversations about connection. And again, I think we're seeing that, again, gardens are so much more than just simply a sum of plants. They're so much more than simply beautiful. They are these amazing repositories of cultural commonwealth, of natural commonwealth. And even if we aren't coming together physically as we maybe have before, I think people are beginning to realize that, man, even this houseplant on my windowsill is doing a lot for me right now in ways that I never really maybe thought it could.
Were you going to pipe in there for a minute, Jennifer?
I was. What is amazing to me in this, you know, not only crisis, but what feels to me like this cultural reset is how many people have reached out to me to say, I'm really sorry it took a crisis to get me to take my garden seriously. And I have had, I am not a how-to garden program. I'm a sort of why we garden program. But the people that I speak with are all how-to and, you know, what do you do in a garden? And I had a really fabulous interaction yesterday where my 22-year-old nephew in Ohio texted me and said, Aunt Jenny, I'm thinking about building a compost bin. Could you give me some pointers? And I thought, this is a great day. Like, when would I have gotten a text from my nephew that said that? And many, many people have reached out to say how comforting their gardens are, especially in this moment where we're not supposed to be touching one another or, you know, touching our own faces, that to go out and put our hands on our plants or in the soil is this incredible human physical and metaphysical connection that we who would love it naturally understand it. But those people who haven't yet been immersed, they now are feeling it and saying, okay, I get it. And that's great.
And it's, well, interesting to me. I may have commented on another show about this, but I have a 2-3 mile sort of walk, jog through my neighborhood. And of course, we're all practicing our personal space and so forth. But last weekend, as I was going around, I noticed how many people were working in their own gardens, their flower garden or their vegetable garden, getting things ready. And they all had smiles on their faces.
Yeah.
Everybody was enjoying and getting back to it. And, you know, from time to time here during the show, we're going to just pop in. And I know we have people with questions and comments, maybe about community, but also some specific kinds of questions. We've talked, and I want to pop in and out with answering some of those questions. And since we've been talking about compost a bit, Karen in La Crosse has a question about it, so let's do a little community here. Karen in La Crosse, thanks for calling.
Thanks, Jennifer, Ben, and Larry. I have a vegetable garden, and every year I put a couple inches of garden compost, and sometimes it's called green earth, on top of the garden before I plant. And I went to get my truckload of it yesterday, and at the nursery, which is a wonderful nursery, they said, this is last year's compost, and it's been covered, and it's been frozen, and now it's thawed, and we're not getting our new compost for about 3 weeks. And I wondered about the nutritional value or its strength if it's last year's compost and it's been overwintered, whether I should use last year's compost or I should wait for the new compost. I didn't know if compost lost its value when it sits all winter.
Ah, well, Ben, do you want to try that?
Sure. As far as I know, you should be in good shape. I think a lot of times sort of those bulk materials, anything that doesn't sell overwinters. And again, in the case of the compost, most of, you know, especially with it being covered, if it had been snowed on and rained on or maybe had salt sprayed on it, you know, or who knows what, then I might raise a question mark. But if it's been covered and frozen, I think it's in just fine shape. You know, there obviously nothing's been growing in it to absorb any of the nutrients that it's holding onto. You know, if it was something like a manure compost, I mean, then of course aging is actually better and a really good thing. But if this is just sort of your again, sort of standard, maybe organic, plant material compost, I think you're safe to go with that material.
So there you go, Karen. And Jennifer, I'm sure you would agree with that.
Totally. And I would say that the biggest point of compost, especially if it's not manure-based, is that it's the organic material that will feed the microorganisms in your existing soil. So it's the addition of that organic material alone, not even its own nutritional elements, that will kickstart the soil that you already have there. So I think you're all set. And in some ways, maybe that extra year of composting is a benefit, just as Ben said.
Actually, yeah, that's what I was thinking as well. So you're, I think, in good shape, Karen. Thank you so much for calling. Jennifer Jewell, our guest today, gardener, garden writer. She has a fascinating book. We're going to be talking about that in just a minute here. It's called The Earth in Her Hand, 75 Extraordinary Women Working in the World of Plants. Ben Fuda with us as well, executive director of the Allen Centennial Gardens. Tyler Ditter, our engineer today. Jill Nadeau, our producer. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. Talking today about our gardening community, and community can be broadly defined across the U.S. or the world. It can be defined as your own kind of neighborhood. And two guests, Jennifer Jewell, who has a wonderful new book out I'm really enjoying. I haven't finished the whole book, but I've read many of the stories that she has in it. The Earth in Her Hands is the title, 75 Extraordinary Women Working in the World of Plants. Ben Fuda, executive director of the Allen Centennial Garden. So it's wonderful talking with them. And I should mention, Bill Martin is our on-air producer, so when you call in today, you'll hear from Bill. He'll answer your questions and maybe hopefully get you on the air. I do want to go to your book, Jennifer, The Earth in Her Hands. Wow. You have some extraordinary women in this book, and it's an absolutely fascinating 75 stories, actually, and more that you write about, and from all over the world.
Yeah, not completely all over the world. I will say that I wish it had been all over the world, but I was able to get pretty broadly based within the world of gardeners who are influenced by the English speaking world. And so there are profiles of women working with plants in the US, in Canada, in England, Australia, Ireland, Japan,
India.
And so, yeah, it was quite a task, actually, to take on in 2017. Timber Press approached me and asked if I would be interested in writing a book on women in horticulture. And we eventually narrowed it down to these 75 women whose work has really kind of expanded what we think of as horticultural in the last 25 years or so. And there were so many ways that you could have tried to arrange such a big heading, you know, women in horticulture. And their one request was that it not be about dead white women in Europe. And I said, great, not hard to not do that. That's been done pretty well, I think, in many ways. So it was a great year to spend immersed in the work of these women who are, you know, doing things across all sectors of our world in terms of growing plants, finding plants, protecting plants, introducing plants, writing about them, photographing them, working with flowers, working with seeds, working with educational organizations and public policy around horticulture. And it was a great year. And it, in many ways, I would say, Larry, that it made clear to me that what we think of as leadership in this world, we often think of something from the top down. And the women in the book, and there are many men in the world doing the same thing, but I was asked to focus on women. They are leading and modeling for us a version of what leadership is that is very, very different. It is very community-minded. It is very horizontal. And it is very focused on improving the world for all people and creatures and organisms for the better. And it was a profound kind of revelation to me that I wasn't just talking about what women are doing in horticulture. I'm talking about, based on their work, how horticulture changes the world for the better.
It's amazing. And I'm just going to add in the photos of the women and some of the other photos connected with it are so striking. When I first looked at your book, I opened it up, and what is the photo I see but the one of Midori Shintani from Japan. It was just a wonderful photo that as I looked at the other photos, I thought, boy, the photographer or photographers really kind of captured the essence of what these women are about. They're really wonderful photos, too.
Well, and I want to follow up on that image of Midori. So Midori is the head of horticulture for the Millennium Forest in Tokaido, Japan, which is a large garden and natural area that was purchased by the leading newspaper in Japan as a carbon offset for their industry. And that picture of Midori, in which she is standing in front of an enormous umbel, maybe a herculaneum, and it is taller than her, and she is in the middle of a forest looking up with sort of joy and reverence at this beautiful flowering stalk above her. And to me, that image actually represents symbolically everything I think the book is about, and that is us as humans in right relationship with the plants and the planet we love. And that is that it is actually bigger than us, and we are there in support of it, not the reverse.
I'm sorry, go ahead. If you were going to...
Yeah, and what was interesting, it sort of ties back into what you commented on about jogging in your neighborhood and seeing people outside working and smiling, is that every single woman was photographed, well, fairly truly. There is a different photograph. I'm going to say that again. There was a different photographer for almost every woman in the book. And yet there was this universal, like, glowing joy to each of these women involved in their work. And so there is this nice cohesiveness to what could have felt very disconnected. And it wasn't.
It's just a wonderful, wonderful photography and wonderful writing to capsule what these women have been doing. Ben, have you worked with any of the women in Jennifer's book, or you have somebody you'd like to talk about?
Well, I think, you know, actually Ava was intended, I believe, is Jennifer correct, is featured in the book?
Yes, Ava Bynum, who was the founder of the Hudson Valley Seeds educational program. Yes.
Yeah, we were sort of unknowingly, when we were putting our symposium together, we had scheduled Ava to join us, and then I reached out to Jennifer, and we realized, oh, there was some unintentional overlap as we were sort of thinking about this topic. You know, I think for me, I like to, you know, I sort of see this, of course, through my personal lens as well, and sort of my personal experience as a gardener. And I think a lot of us who are gardeners have the people in our lives who either said, hey, you might enjoy this, or what if you tried this, or here's plants, try not to kill it. You know, just some of those people who sort of, you know, the puns are rich in gardening, planted the seed for us to do what we do and be so passionate about it. And for me, you know, I kind of like to say that I had enablers more than anything, in the sense that I've always gardened. I've always tinkered in the soil. And, you know, I was fortunate to be in places and spaces with people who recognized that. And instead of trying to direct me into other things, they said, you know, well, here's a plot of soil. This is yours to do with, to experiment and learn. We're not going to tell you what to do or what to plant. You know, at the time, for, you know, 10-year-old Ben, it was, please don't kill the thing that I care about over here. This is where you can, you know, experiment and do things. But, you know, I had many of those places through, you know, my parents and my grandparents. And so those were the people. But I also sort of have a genetic lineage. My great grandparents were small town florists and greenhouse owners, you know, in a rural community with, you know, just a few hundred people, that they were the spot to go to for cut flowers and bedding plants and your vegetable starts in the spring. You know, so this runs really deep for me, again, through sort of the history of my family. And then to be able to make it into a career is just like the best, you know, they'll pay you to do this. Oh, okay. This is work. I guess so. You know, it's just fantastic.
Oh, man. Ben Fuda and Jennifer Jewell, our guests today. Have you had an experience as you listen to these two folks talk? Maybe you know an extraordinary woman working in the world of plants. Tell us about her. And then we have certainly answering gardening questions kind of mixed in as we move along here. We'll sew in a few, so to speak. And Gary, in Stevens Point, has a question about his rhubarb. And let's just go there. Let's go to Gary. Thank you for calling.
Thanks, Larry and Ben and Jen. About a year and a half ago, I called in and asked when I should plant some rhubarb seed. And no one was really sure. I don't remember who your guest was. Doesn't matter. So I planted it in the fall and in the spring, and it didn't come up, so it must not have been viable seed. So I still have some seed left. But to go on to my next question, I have a black walnut tree. Can I till those fronds from last fall into a garden now?
Well, I think there could be some problems associated with planting rhubarb from seed. I don't know that. Ben, have you ever done that?
I haven't. I've always typically bought it as a plant or a root stock or something. I don't have experience doing it from seed myself.
I think it's very difficult to start from seed, which is why typically people buy plants or go to their next door neighbor who's got a plant and you know knock off a piece of it, because the plants themselves grow very well. Jennifer, are you a rhubarb person?
I love rhubarb with my whole heart, and I have never, ever been able to cultivate it in the places where I have gardened. And I think that's as much environmental as it is anything else. But I have never heard of it being successful from seed. Of course, it must be, but I think maybe it takes years. So I would agree with the idea that if you can find someone who grows it successfully and try and mimic the environment in which it is growing successfully, once it goes, it's hard to kill. But I definitely wouldn't put it near the black walnut, however.
No. And I wouldn't use black walnut leaves or anything else because of the juglon in black walnut. It's going to be a problem for many other kinds of plants. So it's... I don't even know if you can compost black walnut. You'd have to have it be a very... Well, I just don't know how you'd do it.
And I just wouldn't do it. I think that allopathic nature of the juglan is not worth composting in anything you're going to put on something you want to grow. Like if you were going to put it on a backfield where you were trying to kill invasive weed seed, maybe.
So there you go, Gary. Thank you so much for calling, talking about our growing community, our garden growing community with Jennifer Jewell and Ben Fuda. Great to have them with us today. You can shoot us an email to ideas@wpr.org or give a call at 800-642-1234. We've got some other gardening questions we'll get to, but also if you have any comments about your own community and what it does in its gardens that means something to you, or maybe an extraordinary person who has who works in the world of plants that you want to tell us about. I hope you'll join in. 800-642-1234. As I look through your book, and I do want to talk about a few of the people who are in the book. And right off the bat, Leslie Bennett is an example of someone who has made a difference. She's the owner and co-founder of, what is it, Pine House Edible Gardens, isn't it?
Yes. She is so Leslie Bennett is a wonderful landscape architect designer here in Northern California out of the Bay Area. And she grew up in the Bay Area to an English mother and a Jamaican father. And she was going to be a lawyer. And this was one of those interesting recurring threads through the book of how many of the women had started down one path and then ended up on a path with plants as their higher calling. And Leslie started Pine House Edible Gardens to help people design beautiful, aesthetically pleasing, integrated, but edible gardens around their homes. And at the same time, having received, I believe, 3 law degrees, she was very interested in the ideas of cultural property and cultural literacy, and how that was one of the elements that gardens are often containers for, and very interested in the idea of the African-American diaspora and the plants that were important to that culture and her father's culture, as well as to any other culture. So in the book, we talk about one of the gardens she helped to design for a Chinese descent gardener in the Bay Area, and incorporating plants that would have been culturally relevant to his ancestors. And this, I found that just to be a really fascinating thread. And she has also since started a project that she calls Black Sanctuary Gardens, in which she underwrites and does quite a bit of pro bono work for helping specifically Black women who might need a garden and not have had access to one before to build one and design one on their home ground. And that's been very powerful work for her.
Yeah. And by cultural, somebody's already asking, by cultural property, I think you were explaining it to us, but maybe what does she mean by cultural property?
Well, so it's a really interesting concept, but she started from the idea of, you know, who owns the Grand Canyon? What is that as a concept? And in our culture, what does it stand for? The same with, say, the Statue of Liberty or the Golden Gate Bridge. Like, these are cultural symbols. They are tangible things, but as symbols and concepts, they belong to everybody. When we think about gardens, I think when you say that word or you say gardener or gardening, a certain image will often come to mind. And, you know, in the past, maybe 50 years, let's say, that image that comes to many people's minds is often represented by a very slim margin of our community. So, and I think that has to do with the way that mainstream media has become so focused on the visual that gardens, you know, especially as seen through large gardening magazines, have a very sort of affluent and tending towards white representation. And the fact is that everybody gardens. Every culture over time and space has a gardening tradition. And so for Leslie, it was important to try and reassert the importance of all kinds of gardening, not just one kind. I hope that makes some sense.
Oh, it does indeed. And it reminded me of another person when you were talking about not necessarily writing and showing the most fabulous gardens, which are wonderful, and I love to see those as mm-hmm. anybody else. But Jamaica Kincaid was another person in your book who I believe, talk about her background, because I think she's an interesting, well, they're all interesting, but she has an interesting background. And when she was asked by the New York Times to write a garden column, she yeah. said, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. No. I will just step in because so she was she's an Antiguan born American author, mostly known as a novelist. She is a professor of African American studies at Harvard currently. And she was born in Antigua and came to the U.S. as a young woman to be a domestic worker, and sort of quickly realized that that isn't what she wanted to do. And she took herself to a community college and then got a full scholarship into another 4-year college, and then decided that's not what she wanted to do. took herself to New York and started writing and freelance photography. And ultimately, through persistence and talent, got herself on staff at The New Yorker and was on staff as a writer for The New Yorker magazine for 23 years, I believe. And over the course of this time, she herself became an avid gardener, and she studied the plants that she was falling in love with and putting in her garden. And as she says, the garden brought the world to me. So, you know, she would plant a peony and she would study where it came from and how to grow it and, you know, the different varieties and the cultural history behind where it came from and how it was brought to the U.S. and to her garden. And what she came to realize was that there was a lot, you know, especially when you look at plants and their names, there was this inherent colonial and racist structure in our horticultural world. And it was, it is complex. It is complicated and tricky to talk about. And yet for her, it was very important. And I think for all of us, it's important to hear her when she says, what is, you know, when she was writing these essays for The New Yorker in the mid-1990s, she said, you know, what is the place of a brown girl like me in a story like this? And what do I do with that? And her series of articles for The New Yorker in the mid-1990s was collected into a book titled My Garden Book. And it is a fascinating exploration of the history of how plants are named and what does that mean and what do we do with that. So I'll give you an example. She explores in the book the fact that the dahlia wasn't originally called the dahlia. It was called some word I cannot pronounce from South and Central America, and it had a rich cultural history of for both ritual and spiritual and, I believe, medicinal purposes, not for the beautiful bloom we value it for today. It was, quote unquote, discovered by explorers and then brought to a European country and then passed around European countries, and it was given the name dahlia. And in giving it that name, in order to add it to the, you know, binomial nomenclature that we are inheritors of, it essentially erased the history that came before it. And so that possessing of a thing and its history by renaming it is another form of colonization and erasure that as gardeners today, we can think about and decide, what do we want to do with that? Is that the only legacy we want to make sure is heard and seen and valued? And what I like to say when I'm in a conversation, in a talk with a group, Larry, is that if there was racism built into our gardening culture, and there was, then there are gardeners now who can identify it and dig it out and compost it, transforming it into something better and bigger than that truth. And that's up to all of us to do.
Jennifer Jewell, her book is called The Earth in Her Hand, 75 Extraordinary Women Working in the World of Plants. One of our guests today, the other, Ben Fuda, Executive Director of the Allen Centennial Gardens. And we'll take some more calls when we come back. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for being with us on the Ideas Network for this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller with my two guests, Jennifer Jewell, author of The Earth in Her Hand, 75 Extraordinary Women Working in the World of Plants. She has her own radio show and podcast, and it's been great talking with her, as it has been great talking again with Ben Fuda, Executive Director of the Allen Centennial Gardens on the UW-Madison campus. And we're talking about gardening as a community, looking at many, certainly in Jennifer's book, many of the women who have had a huge impact on their communities sometimes their local communities, but oftentimes on the national and even world community when it comes to plants. And so we're visiting with them about that and mixing in questions that are specific questions relating to gardens as well. Judy in Ripon has a question, and I will give her a chance to join in. Hi, Judy. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I absolutely love mandevillas, and so I brought mine in over the winter and have done this for several years, and they do well in the house. But I tried to recently root them, and they have those nodes, and it's really, you can see where the node is. And I've tried putting them in water. I've tried putting them in soil. I've used rooting powder. I've had absolutely no luck, no matter how many times and how many different ways I've tried to do it. I just cannot get these to root. Do you have any suggestions?
Ben, what about, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh,
Ben.
Yeah. Have you tried layering them? I haven't propagated them myself, so I can't speak for sure, but I mean, another method that comes to mind could be layering them. So, sort of taking one of those vines and, laying it sort of on the top edge of soil, maybe removing a couple of leaves by the nodes, but basically just sort of like you would maybe try to propagate like a hydrangea or viburnum or something like that. You can just, where any of those branches and a node sort of touches the ground, it'll root while it's still connected to the mother plant. So maybe rather than taking cuttings, maybe seeing if leaving it connected makes any difference.
Oh, I think that's a good idea. Jennifer, what about a comment from you?
I think that's a great idea for trying and make sure to weight it down so that it stays.
Yep.
Rooted, it stays in direct contact with the soil there. I think that's a great idea.
Can you actually put the node under the soil then, or no?
I would cover it a little bit.
Yeah, just a little bit.
Yep.
Okay.
All right.
I saw that. Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. And while we're at it, we'll just take another question here from Bill in Deerfield. Bill, hello.
Hi, Larry. This is a really, really great show. And Jennifer, I am definitely going to get your book. My grandmother got me into gardening way back in the early 60s, and now it is my vocation. And just on your theme, my little village of Deerfield has about 40 planters down its main street, and I plant and maintain those, and I have for about the last 20 years. And I'm looking forward to getting the pansies and primulas in pretty soon. And I think it, I hope it gives, some cohesion to the village. And I get some good feedback. And Larry, I'm not extraordinary by any means, but I love this show. I do have a specific question about a product I actually heard on your show. It's a deer repellent called Skid, and it's 100%. Blood meal, and I wonder if I'm using this in my flower garden, am I over-nitrogenizing my flower garden?
Hmm. Well, I don't think so. Ben, what do you think?
I don't, offhand, this isn't something I have a ton of experience with, so I don't want to sound in not knowing for sure.
Yeah, I'm Jennifer, are you familiar with...
No. No idea. And if it's 100% blood meal, it might repel the deer, but does it attract other things also? That's interesting. I've never heard of it. So it'll be interesting to see. Yeah, I don't know.
We'd have to look up the composition of blood meal. And if I'm not sure about the nitrogen content that may exist in blood meal. I'll look that up here, and we'll see what we can come up with, Bill. And so stay listening, and we'll see if we can come up with something. Thank you very much for calling. And one more call, Shake in Madison.
Morning. I'm curious. This year, the frost depth made it all the way down to 1 inch to 2 inches in my area, and I'm in Madison. What effect is that going to have on perennials and my natives that supposedly like cool weather?
So there hasn't been enough cool weather, in your opinion, Shake?
plants over the last 20 years and attributing a great deal of it to climate change. But this year with the frost, there were spots where we had no frost.
Yeah. Interesting. Ben, what do you think?
At least in my experience, from what I've seen, most things, again, especially natives and so forth, again, even if it doesn't, the frost, I think if this were to persist for several years, and again, your point with, changes due to climate, I think we may really see some things begin to shift and act and behave differently. For the most part, as long as my guess would be, as long as there's enough cold to sort of induce dormancy, where, you know, the plant wasn't still actively growing or sort of doing anything it wasn't supposed to be doing during the winter, that for the time being, we're probably okay. The concern could be that next winter we would have a swing to the other extreme and a very severe cold snap. I think the good news for, again, if you're gardening with a lot of native plants, is that, I'm painting with a very broad brush here, but generally speaking, you know, they are typically more adaptable to, at least our local conditions than maybe some of newer plants and introductions. Again, that is not an all things created equal statement, but, I think, if we'd had no frost this year, or if we had 65 degrees in January for a week, then I'd be really, really concerned. But again, at least it got cold, even though it didn't get deeply cold, it stayed fairly chilly for a decent amount of time. So I'm not terribly concerned that this year as we were last year with the polar vortex. That said, observation is where we're going to go with a lot of this stuff, I think. Paying attention to those plants that can tolerate these sort of disruptive and different conditions, and taking note of those as we move forward.
Yeah. And, over time, some of those plants that, actually grew well in this, our climate here in Wisconsin, may not do well over the long period of time, I think. And Jennifer, I know there are women in your book who, I was just to this whole topic of climate change, that have strong feelings and work in this area.
Well, and just to address a little bit off of the caller's question, I think this is a great time to invite the citizen scientist in all of us to keep journals if we can, and even photographic journals to help document how our landscapes are changing with changing weather patterns, so that in 5 years you can look back and say, did this affect my Rudbeckia, my peony, my lilac, whatever it might be that you're watching and worrying about, because there will be some natural migration by the plants themselves to the areas they want to be. And I think it will be interesting to watch. I don't know if anybody who's listening or the caller has read In Search of the Canary Tree, which is about the research into the loss of Alaskan yellow cedar up in Alaska, and basically documenting how the lack of snowfall over a long period of time, over several, many, many winters now, the continuing hard freezes in the late spring without that snow cover is actually sort of making these ancient trees freeze to death because they don't have that insulating blanket of the snow. So I think it's an interesting time to be curious and to try and keep as many notes as we can, because those notes will then help inform how do we respond to what we see.
Yeah.
And I would say that, of the women in the book, certainly all of the women are very concerned and compelled by the idea of climate change to address it in their work the best that they can, from the botanists to the field botanists and research scientists on how do we address, say, invasive plants, how do we protect biodiversity in our national forests, and it's a recurring concern, certainly.
a very recurring concern. Sheikh, thanks again for your questions. Appreciate your call very much. Well, our guest today, Jennifer Jewell Gardner, gardening writer, gardening educator and advocate. Since 2016, she's written and hosted the national award-winning public radio program and podcast called Cultivating Place. And the book that she's authored is called The Earth in Her Hands, 75 Extraordinary Women Working in the World of Plants. Ben Fuda, our guest as well, executive director of the Allen Centennial Gardens. He directs the operations of the gardens and its programs and has a background in landscape architecture and sustainability. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Glad to have you listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about gardening as a community and talking about people who work in gardening and with plants. And, of course, answering your gardening questions as well on the show. Ben Fuda, executive director of the Allen Centennial Garden in Madison, one of our guests. The other, Jennifer Jewell, the author of a fascinating book. It's called The Earth in Her Hands, 75 Extraordinary Women Working in the World of Plants. She also hosts the national award-winning weekly public radio program and podcast called Cultivating Place. So what gardening questions do you have? How does gardening enrich your life? We'd love to hear from you. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org. And Jennifer, as I was going through your book, I had a big smile on my face when I saw Leah Penniman's photo.
Mm. Yeah.
She's an extraordinary. I have not met her in person, but I've we're hoping to have her come to the UW-Madison campus at some point to speak. And so I listened to her speak on a podcast kind of thing, and she's an extraordinary woman. Talk about Leah Penniman.
She has been a guest on my program and is just an extraordinary, to use the word again, as in the title of the book, an extraordinary woman leader in our times. She is an educator and founder of Soul Fire Farm in upstate New York. And she and her, their sort of journey story is that she and her husband were both high school teachers, college educated, young family started, and they were living by choice as a car-free family in Albany. And she and her husband realized that in the neighborhood they were living in the time that they were there and in a predominantly black and multiracial neighborhood, that there was very few places that they could access fresh food and fresh produce in their neighborhood, and that in order to get to a store that had fresh food, they had to take a variety of buses in order to get there. And what they realized was that as two working, college-educated people with small children, if this was difficult for them to figure out and make happen, then it was almost impossible for those who had less educational and resource privilege than they had. And to Leah's mind, this was absolutely unacceptable. And in some cases, we are perhaps familiar with the idea of a food desert, those areas of urban life and sometimes rural life in which there is no access to fresh food at your grocery store, fresh fruits and vegetables, and people will refer to it as a food desert. And in Leah's mind, it was very clearly not a food desert, but it was food apartheid, that it was part of the social and political structure that had created these areas of great lack. And she decided that it was one of her callings in life to address this. And so she and her husband started a farm, Soulfire Farm, in which one of the first things they did when they got it off the ground was to offer reduced, you know, or at cost CSA memberships to the community that they had lived in. And they delivered the food and they changed the lives dramatically of, you know, I think 350 households. And as the farm went along, what she also came to realize was that there was this incredible disconnect between what she felt, her great love of farming and the land, and what most people in her African American community felt or understood to be joyful. And she wanted to address that. And she wrote a phenomenally illuminating book for anybody called Farming While Black. And through her work, both as a speaker and a leader and an educator at Soulfire Farm and through her writing, she really expands and changes the way we can all think about horticultural history and the role of different cultures within that history. It's really profoundly expanding.
It's she's just an extraordinary person, and it was I was really happy to see her as one of the people in your book for sure. Ben, have you had? Do you know Leah Penniman or know of her?
I do. Yeah. Well, I should say not personally. You know, she's been on our radar as well as someone we'd love to get to Madison as well. So. Larry, we'd love to collaborate on that between the gardens someday as that moment arrives.
We have a global day that has had to have been canceled here on campus where we were bringing in speakers. And one of the speakers that we had wanted to bring in and hoped to be able to bring in was Leah Penniman. And so I had looked into more deeply into her work. And she's really, really fantastic person by everything I can imagine. Well, as we've been talking about the book and the extraordinary women, I've got some more of questions about that. But we have some questions from our listeners that relate to our own gardens. So let's go to Hugh in Appleton, who's been waiting a bit. Hugh, thank you for waiting. You've got a question about composting, I think.
Yes. Last fall, I cut and bagged grass and maple leaves from my lawn, and I placed them on a 14-by-8-foot garden that I have, and they piled up about 18 inches high. And I turned them over recently, and they were wet, but there's no deep composition. I really didn't expect too much. It settled some. It's still wet, but it's too much to till in. Do you have any suggestions?
Hmm.
Yeah, so I think you just saved yourself a bunch of work for the spring, actually, with you not needing to bring mulch in right now. Rather than filling it in, what I might suggest is if you're going to plant even whether it's direct sow or transplant, where you're going to plant specifically, maybe, you know, pull those leaves away there from just that spot. But again, they're mulching in place. They're going to keep your weeds down beautifully for the year. And again, as they decompose, you know, you're right, that they'll be really great for the soil throughout the year. So I wouldn't plant into the leaf compost itself, but again, maybe especially if it's thick, just pull it back a bit, you know, so that you can still get at the soil and make sure that the crown of either, again, your transplants or the seeds themselves aren't too buried. But I would essentially leave it in place and, as much as you possibly can. But I don't think there's a need to till it in at this stage.
Yeah, Jennifer, I certainly agree with it. Jennifer, I imagine you do as well.
Absolutely. As long as they are not creating an anaerobic mat that is, you know, going to kill other, like your other shoots coming up, to not till is always the best approach, because the soil and the microorganisms in their little houses in the soil don't want to be disturbed, and they will just very happily start to eat that as it warms up and they get activated. And yeah, it's the perfect mulch and topping to get everything going.
Yeah, absolutely. Hugh, thank you so much. Well, we're on mulch. Barb has something kind of relating to that from Wausau, so let's just take that. Hi, Barb.
Hi. I have a question about, you were talking about you were spreading the mulch at the botanical garden, and I'm just wondering what kind of mulch can you spread that the jumping worms don't like?
That's a very good question. So we actually, this is our first year using leaf compost, and so and again, even calling it compost maybe isn't the best term, because again, similar to the last caller, these were leaves that were collected in the fall. For the first time this year, we worked with campus specifically to collect leaves from around campus, and so as they were doing their fall cleanup, they dumped a couple of loads in sort of our back storage area. So in our case, at least, the garden already has jumping worms, unfortunately. It's a sort of our reality these days. And so we're not terribly worried about introducing them necessarily. But even that said, you know, they were dumped on a concrete slab. They were covered with a tarp over the winter. So they didn't have contact with, again, they were not pre-composted beyond over the winter. You know, they weren't sitting on soil someplace that hasn't been turned necessarily. This is basic, again, pretty fresh, fairly fresh material that we're using as mulch. That said, again, if you're going to your local garden centers or providers looking for good mulch solutions, I would just really ask them point blank what they have and what's accessible. You know, I think it's something that everyone, especially in this area, has been looking into and thinking about in recent years. You know, I know a lot of, I believe recent research I've seen, you know, how hot the compost can get as it's sort of fermenting and decomposing has an impact. But maybe if you can even, you know, if you're not happy with the answers you're getting from your garden centers, maybe even try and going directly to the source. So some of the garden centers sort of resell material from you know, other providers. Maybe even checking in with those, sort of that original source material, and sort of asking them what their protocol is and what they would recommend for that as well.
Yeah,
you can never go wrong with leaves from your own own property either, especially if you don't have the worms.
Yeah, Jennifer, do you are you blessed in quotes with jumping worms?
No, so I just had to go Google what a jumping worm how people are controlling them, because I've heard of them, but as far as I know, we don't have them here, or not in my home garden immediate region. Wow.
There. Yeah. Well, read up on them a little bit, because you're not going to like what you see. I can tell you that for sure. They're a big problem in some parts of Wisconsin right now, for sure. And we'll take one more call. Dennis in Two Rivers. And Barb, thank you again. Dennis now in Two Rivers, it's your turn.
Hi. Each spring I end up with a lot of tree seeds from other people's trees, and I don't have space for the trees to grow. And I'm wondering, well, can I compost or somehow put the seeds somewhere where they won't grow?
So winds from tree seeds, are these the helicopter type seeds? Is that what you're talking about, Dennis?
Yeah, and they land on my lawn. I wonder, well, where am I going to put them where they won't grow? Because I don't have space. I mean, they could grow into a forest. And I try pushing them off into a pile in my lawn, and then they end up growing there. So what am I going to do with them?
That is a very good question. One sort of initial thought, I guess, if you can, if you have other lawn and sort of garden debris, you know, whether it's grass clippings or again leaves maybe from last year, maybe putting the seeds at the very bottom of the pile. So if they're smothered, you know, if it's only an inch or two, that probably isn't going to be enough to really prevent them from growing. But if it's a, you know, 10, 12 inches worth of material or more, you might have a few pop through that. But I would think that, you know, if it's too deep, it would inhibit them and they would eventually break down. I don't know the lifespan of the viability of maples or other other tree seeds right offhand.
Yeah. I think one thing, Dennis, if you can, sounds like you've been able to collect them and put them in a pile. I would, one thing you could do is get yourself some black plastic bags and put them right in the bags and then let the bags sit in the sun for a year. And I think you're going to find that the heat from the sun is going to bake those seeds. Jennifer, would you agree with that?
I would. I know several gardeners here who use the plastic bags that come from, you know, if you get a bag of soil instead of a truckload of soil, and they put all their invasive seeds and seed heads inside these bags, add a little water, leave it in the hot sun, and it effectively just kind of boils it down and solarizes it into kind of black fertilizer you can put on the garden next year when everything is dead inside of it.
Yeah. So there, as long as you can get them raked up like that, Dennis, that's definitely what I would. I know exactly what you're talking about because I have every once in a while one of those little trees pops up, and then some, if you let them go any length of time, they're little devils to get out. So they need to be taken care of right away, for sure. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. I want to go back to your book a little bit more, Jennifer. There's a Vandana Shiva of India was a very interesting person to me. Here's somebody who just decided, I'm going to get a community going make a difference. Talk about her.
Well, I think many listeners will be familiar with the name Vandana Shiva. She's a globally known advocate for ecological farming and gardening and for the protection of seed as life and seed not to be patented. She really started on her work. She was also doing a higher education path of a different kind. And in her region of India in the late 1960s and 70s, there were some devastating fires in fertilizer factories there. And the farmers in her region were getting increasingly hobbled by the ideas that had been sold to them post-Green Revolution, wherein people were told that if they planted these seeds, they would have improved productivity. These seeds were patented and they needed to be fertilized with these synthetic fertilizers in order to increase productivity. And this is how we were going to feed the world. And there was, over, you know, a period of many years, this increasing awareness that the idea was maybe well-intentioned, maybe commercially intentioned. And but what was in fact happening was that these small farmers were losing their livelihood to large corporations who were selling them the seed and the fertilizer, and their soil was decreasing in tilth and health. And it was a terribly hobbling situation that was getting worse every year. And she took it on herself to really try and change this conversation and protect the idea of heirloom open pollinated seeds and the rights of small farmers to care for their land in traditional ecological ways that had proved very useful and healthful over centuries, and returning that conversation to the landholders as opposed to corporate interests. And she, in many cases, correlates the way we treat the globe and the planet that we live on with the way we treat women in general. And Her ecological feminism is a fascinating conversation, and she has been able to effect some really profound change at a public policy level across nations. And I think that kind of brings me back to the importance of conversations like this, Larry, and gardens like the Allen Centennial Garden being run by Ben, and the way in which he is seeking to make these public spaces, these physical public spaces, as well as conceptual ones like a radio conversation or Vandana Shiva's, paradigm, into places where we really learn and we really connect and we have conversations that grow us all. And I think that as our culture right now is finding ways to improve the relevance of public spaces like museums and botanic gardens, this kind of insight and foresight will be critically important to having botanical gardens be places of incredible learning and growth for our culture.
And we have some wonderful gardens here, botanical gardens in Wisconsin that are doing just an absolutely fantastic job, including Ben's garden, as I might call it. It's Ben Stover C, but it's a garden for all of us, Alan, Centennial Gardens. You know, Jennifer, as you're with the COVID-19, how is it? I know you do a lot of speaking at events. I'm sure this has had an effect on you.
Well, yes. Sadly, today we were supposed to be at the Allen Centennial Yes. Garden at the wonderful symposium that Ben put together. Having these kinds of important conversations, and that had to be postponed. And I think all of my speaking events, I had a fairly extensive book tour in place. All of my events through the end of April currently have been postponed out. Very few have canceled. Most people want to see these conversations go forward a little later in the year, and we'll just see how it unfolds. But in the meantime, I think that it becomes clear, more clear to us gardeners every day, what places of transformation and solace and connection our gardens are going to be as we move through this particular chapter in our history.
Yeah, I was looking forward to that symposium as well, because we were going to be broadcasting live from it.
Yeah.
So it's a real pleasure to have both of you with us today. I want to thank you so much, Jennifer and Ben, for being with us. And Jennifer, thank you for writing this book, The Earth in Her Hands. It's a wonderful book. Appreciate it very much. Thank you both.
Thank you.
And Jennifer Jewell's book is called The Earth in Her Hands, 75 Extraordinary Women Working in the World of Plants. Please take a look at it. I'm sure you're going to enjoy it. And I hope you enjoyed the show today. I certainly did. And I hope you will stay with us right through the afternoon, because there's lots more in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk.